Okay, a couple of announcements before we start. In your packet are from House Research from Don Helen is an information brief on endocrine disruptors, because that is going to be our topic for today. You'll also find an article from the Washington Post. We sent around one for you from Idaho that was interesting because it was Idaho and it was long and fairly inclusive. Also, since we're going to be talking about Forest Legacy, I just call your attention to an article from the Federal Reserve Board. They put an article on easements in the woods, and this is for their feature in January. It's long and I think pretty complete. The other thing I wanted to do when I introduce our speaker is Dr. Schoenfuss from St. Cloud University. I want just to mention that we also sent around a link to you on your website where he is featured in a news piece by Rick Capitello of Care 11 News. Care 11 will be, I have been told, will be following this issue, and so I just wanted to call that to your attention in case you were interested in looking at that. With that, I would like to welcome Dr. Schoenfuss to the committee and appreciate his driving down from St. Cloud so early in the morning.
Thank you, Representative Fagina.
And if you just put your name on the record, we'll take about an hour if there are questions for members or you begin.
Good morning. My name is Heiko Schoenfuss. I'm an assistant professor of anatomy and the director of the Aquatic Toxicology Laboratory at St. Cloud State University. I do appreciate the opportunity to spend a little time this morning introducing the topic of emerging contaminants or endocrine disruptors to this committee, and please feel free to interrupt me. I'm planning for about 35 minutes to introduce this topic with ample of time for questions, but if I miss on something, if I skip something, please interrupt me. I prefer that to missing an important point. I titled this overview Assessing the Threats of Emerging Contaminants on Wildlife and Human Health. There are several terms out there: emerging contaminants, endocrine disruptors, environmental estrogens. Many of these are used in a very common context, so they are almost seen as synonyms at this point, even though they technically aren't. Just a very quick overview of the structure of my presentation this morning. I will speak briefly about what are emerging contaminants, what classes of chemicals do we usually refer to as emerging contaminants. I need to introduce very briefly the complexity of the endocrine system, because that's the main target of many of these emerging contaminants in the human body as well as in wildlife. A overview of the current knowledge: what do we know about emerging contaminants, what are their effects on wildlife. Some of the current research questions that plague us in this scientific field, and probably for your benefit, the question, why do we know so little about these contaminants? There has been a lot of research being done in the past 10 years, but it seems like we are only scratching at the surface. More specifically for the state of Minnesota, some of the current research efforts that are underway to elucidate the problems with emerging contaminants and the assessment of threat related to these compounds. And I know that there's always the concern for the human health risk of emerging contaminants, and I will just say a few words about that before I conclude with some suggestions. A very common definition of emerging contaminants, and a somewhat wordy one, are exogenous chemicals that cause adverse health effects in an organism, its progeny, and changes that are usually found within the endocrine system. And this is the important aspect here. The effects of emerging contaminants may not manifest themselves for many years after exposure has occurred, and I will give you some examples of that a little later on. I list on the bottom there in three images some of the very common emerging contaminants coming out of household or industrial cleaners, the things you may have in your medicine cabinet, and agriculture probably contributes to emerging contaminants as well. The important thing, without going into too much detail, to notice here is that emerging contaminants interact with hormone receptors on the cells in our bodies. Hormone receptors are essentially little locks on each cell, and the hormone acts somewhat as a key that unlocks a particular mechanism within a cell and causes a whole cascade of events. I just listed one here, the estrogen receptor. You would have the hormone, in this case estrogen, interact with the receptor site that is specific to estrogen, and as a result we probably express some proteins or have some sort of cellular process going on. It's important to note that receptors are found on all cells in the human body, on all cells in every organism, even in plants. Estrogen receptors are very, very common, and many of these emerging contaminants are acting on this estrogen receptor. In other words, unfortunately, there's not just one key to open that lock of an estrogen receptor. There are many, many copies, and some of them are fakes, and some of them are reals, and the human body, or the body of any other organism, has no means to determining whether this is an estrogen interacting with this estrogen receptor or some other emerging contaminant. As a result, for those of us studying those compounds, it is very difficult to determine whether a shift in how an organism operates is due to hormones released by that organism or maybe emerging contaminants interacting with the organism itself. The issue of emerging contaminants really came to the forefront here in the U.S. with a U.S. Geological Survey study that was published a few years back that seeked out rivers and other waterways that were most likely impacted by humans. And all they did is they ran very extensive analyses of those rivers and waterways, and what they found was rather astonishing. They were able to measure in a lot of these water samples antibiotics, prescription drugs, non-prescription drugs, hormones and steroids, the kind of things we produce, and household and industrial cleaners. It was a little bit surprising because some of these compounds we don't think of as being produced in the kind of quantities that we usually associate with aquatic pollution. We're talking about very, very minute quantities. And here are some of those emerging contaminants. On the left, you have a column called the natural estrogens, and I just included, for giggles, the formulas of those. The most potent one, 17-beta-estradiol. This is the primary estrogen all vertebrates produce. And we usually associate estrogen, of course, with female organisms, but in reality, estrogen is produced by males as well as females, and testosterone, the male hormone, the primary principal male hormone, is actually only one step removed from estrogen. The point I'm trying to make here is that males are susceptible to estrogen just as much, if not more so, than females. Males also have estrogen receptors, these receptor sites that serve as locks that can be unlocked to instigate certain cellular functions. So estradiol, the primary estrogen produced in all vertebrates, estrone and estriol are other hormones that are produced by all of us. Now these hormones are generally excreted with the urine into the wastewater stream, and their design is relatively stable, so they will move into the aquatic environment without much degradation through the wastewater treatment process. In addition to these natural estrogens, which we do pick up in wastewaters and even in rivers and streams, we also have a plethora of synthetic estrogens present. Ethanol estradiol is probably the overall most potent emerging contaminant out there. It's the active ingredient of the birth control pill, and it goes through the same excretion process as the natural estrogens. It's released with the urine into the wastewater stream and ultimately ends up in the aquatic environment. Nonylphenol and the class of alkylphenols is a very different animal here. These are detergents. They're used to spread things evenly over surface. They're used to interact with both water and lipids, so if you have a really greasy pan at home and you try to clean it with a degreasing agent, if you work in your car and you want to get the oil off your hands, you're most likely using alkylphenols to achieve that. Car washes, dry cleaners, many, many applications, de-icing fluids when you board an airplane in the winter, except for this winter, all of those will include alkylphenols. They're designed to interact with the watery phase, so with the wastewater stream, they also end up in the aquatic environment. bisphenol A is a compound that has received a lot of attention lately, and we're having a hard time dealing with it. It's ubiquitous in the aquatic environment, and it's ubiquitous in our life. I look around the table here, and I see all kinds of plastic products. What makes plastic pliable, like those water bottles in front of you, is a plasticizer called bisphenol A. Plastic is actually a very brittle substance until you add bisphenol A to it, and that bisphenol A will slowly leach out of the plastic into the water and into the wastewater stream. Other compounds that fall into the same category of emerging contaminants, i.e. interacting with estrogen or other receptors on the cells, are the perfluorochemicals, and of course you've heard about those very recently. These are the non-stick agents that are applied to things like Teflon pans, many food packagings, and so on, and I will present some data on those as well. You may not think that DDT is something of an emerging contaminant. After all, it has been around for a long time, and we banned it a long time ago in this country. It turns out at low concentrations, it's actually a very potent estrogen. It will bind to the estrogen receptor and give the cell signals just like the estrogens that would be produced naturally by the body. An area in which we are just starting to understand a little bit of what's going on are the pharmaceuticals. We're measuring more and more pharmaceuticals in surface waters, in streams, in rivers. I will give you some data on that in a minute too. And one particular class concerns us. It has a very long name, serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. Inhibitors. SSRI is too short, for short. Many of the mood-altering drugs fall into that category. So Prozac, Wellbutrin, and about 12 or so other very similar drugs have been measured in treated effluents and to a lesser degree in surface waters. Carbamazepine, an anti-epileptic drug, we find in surface waters in Minnesota. Musk and fragrances, all the things that make your soap smell good, your shampoo, all those kind of compounds act on the estrogen receptor. And again, they're designed to be in a watery phase, and they make it all the way through the treatment process into the wastewater. In recent years, the industry has been very good in promoting antimicrobial soaps. Triclosan and other active ingredients in those soaps end up in the wastewater, and we will measure those as well. Even harder to deal with are some of the industrial effluents, pulp and paper mills. We know they are either estrogenic, acting on the estrogen receptors, or androgenic, acting on androgen testosterone receptors in the body. And then the pesticides. And pesticides are interesting as well for two reasons. Usually they don't enter the surface water via the treated wastewater stream. They come in as runoff from fields and so on. But these pesticides are complex formulations where you have the active compound, atrazine and clozalin being examples, but you also have other things in there, like surfactants, our alkaphenols, are mixed together with those pesticides to make them, to apply them more evenly to your plant surface. All right, I mentioned a lot about the endocrine system, and I just want to introduce it very briefly, refresh some of those biology courses. The endocrine system is one of our two principal systems of the body that regulate how our body works. One is the nervous system, and it deals with the kind of short-term things. You pull your handbag if there's a heat source that you don't want to get burned on. The endocrine system usually works more on a long-term developmental aspect of your life. In other words, during your development, during your maturation, it's the endocrine system, through its many glands, that will release hormones that slowly but surely develop the body towards maturity. Reproduction is almost exclusively controlled by these hormones released by the endocrine system. So what you see in this image on the left is just a depiction of many of the glands in the human body. And the important thing here is these glands are not connected like nerves by structures. Hormones are released into the bloodstream, and they will circulate through the entire body and cause effects in many different places all at once. So it's a ductless system consisting of many glands. The primary sender is the hypothalamus. That's the gland, let me see if I can show that up here, right there in the very center of your brain. If you peel everything away from the brain, what you're left with is a hypothalamus. And then the hypothalamus will interact with the pituitary gland, which is still located in your skull, sends out hormone signals to other parts of your body, including the reproductive organs, the ovaries and testes. Now, at each level, hormones are released and hormones cause actions to the next lower level of glands. But at each level also, there are feedback cycles that tell the other glands what's going on. So, for example, if you increase reproductive activities, you decrease some of the other absorptive mechanisms of the body. It's a very intricate system that I have greatly simplified here on the right side of this diagram to just demonstrate how many different feedback loops there are, how many different cascades of events have to go on for reproduction behavior that is associated with reproduction to occur. At each step, hormones are involved. At each step, receptor cells are involved. And at each step, emerging contaminants can potentially interfere with those normal concentrations of hormones and tell the receptor sites to do something they would otherwise not do. What is even more remarkable is that this system is about 500 million years old. In other words, what we see at receptor sites and hormones in a fish is remarkably similar to what we see in a human. Now, I will talk primarily about effects of emerging contaminants on fishes today, because that's where we have the most experience. But I want you to keep in mind that the human system is very similar, and in fact, when we study the endocrine system, we usually do it on fishes because they don't complain quite as much as human patients generally do. So, if we see effects in fishes, we at least have to worry that something similar may be happening in humans. I know you're anxious to see some of the values here in Minnesota, and I just listed a snapshot, and I want to emphasize this is a snapshot of values measured in effluents in the state of Minnesota of some of these compounds I mentioned earlier. Among the natural estrogens, I have data for estradiol and estrone, and their ranges are generally in the parts per trillion range. Parts per trillion is very hard to comprehend. And I did a little napkin calculation. If you take an Olympic-sized swimming pool and you drip in one drop of sweat, probably before you start working out, you're in the parts per million range, 1,000 times more than what we measure and 1,000 times more than what causes effects at those concentrations. Most of these hormones in the human body will occur in parts per trillion of even lower concentrations. So although these concentrations are very, very small, they are concentrations that we know are causing effects in organisms. Some of the other compounds, the synthetic emerging contaminants, ethanol estradiol, the active ingredient in the birth control pill, about 100 times more potent than the natural estradiol, our most common hormone, somewhere in the neighborhood of non-detect, ND stands for non-detect, and that goes back to our analytical methods not being up to snuff, to about 3 parts per trillion. Nonylphenol, that was a detergent that we used as a degreasing agent, somewhere between parts per trillions and parts per millions, billions, I'm sorry. When we take all those different detergents together, we measure actually in effluents about 50 parts per billion. Bisphenol A, the plasticizer out of those bottles that are pliable, those plastic bottles, somewhere in the parts per trillion to about 10 parts per billion range. Let's talk about some of the pharmaceutical. Prozac, or the active ingredient fluoxetine, we measured in treated effluent somewhere between 51 and 83 parts per trillion. That's not a very high number. But when we take all of these very similar SSRIs together, all of these mood-altering drugs, we actually come up with a number in treated effluent of about 10 parts per billion, and that is a very high number. The antiepileptic drug, carbamazepine, somewhere in the parts per trillion to parts per billion range. Triclosan, one of the most commonly used antimicrobial hand soap ingredients, 82 to 300 some parts per trillion. And these perfluorochemicals that we heard so much about lately, we found, and this is in fish tissue, concentrations in the state of Minnesota between 3.5 and 28 nanograms per gram. If you translate that into something more along the scale that I enjoy, which is eating fish, if you take 100 grams of fish, which is about a fifth of a pound, so fairly small, at least for me it's a fairly small ratio of fish, you get about 2 micrograms of perfluorochemical in your diet with that one consumption. These are very small concentrations, and it's probably hard to make out what that actually means. So I want to present a few data that come out of Minnesota where we try to evaluate what are these relevant concentrations actually doing to organisms that are exposed to them. Now I want to start out with a group of chemicals that I've spent a lot of time working on, the alkylphenols. Again, just to remind you, those are the detergents, the degreasing agents, the things we add to the icing fluid to make it spread evenly, the things we use in dry cleaners and car washes to get rid of oils. We took larval fathead minnows in the laboratory. These were freshly hatched fathead minnows. And we exposed them to a mixture of all these alkylphenols we measured in treated effluent, about twice at the concentration at which we measured it in the effluent. And within about 30 days, in two trials, all the larvae had died. So that's twice the concentration of what we had measured in an effluent. The larvae that were not exposed lived just fine. And you see that with the two graphs here, or the two lines that dropped to the bottom, these are the exposed larvae, and they all died in 30 days. That was twice the concentration of just one group of these compounds causing mortality. When we exposed freshly hatched larvae, again, fathead minnows, to just half of the concentration that we had measured of these alkylphenols, so half of what they would experience if they would swim into that effluent, and we grew them to adulthood. They were not exposed for 4 months. They were just initially exposed, allowed to grow up in clean water. They were not able to compete with their unexposed counterparts for reproductive opportunities. In other words, these fish dropped out of the population as far as reproduction was concerned. Let's look a little bit at the Mississippi River. I apologize, this map is probably not as clear as it could be. What you're seeing here is the Mississippi watershed in the state of Minnesota, and the river would run from about right up here, Lake Itasca, Bemidji, down to Grand Rapids, past St. Cloud, to the Twin Cities, and down towards Iowa. We conducted a study last summer in which we measured chemical concentrations at 43 sites along the course of the Mississippi River here in Minnesota, and we also took fish samples at 42 sites. And what I outlined here with those red circles and ellipsoid shapes are sites in which we found something that is usually referred to as feminization in male fish. These male fish produce a protein called vitellogenin that female fish usually produce when they get ready to spawn. Vitellogenin is an egg yolk protein. It's used widely, and you probably read it in some of the literature that was forwarded to you. Vitellogenin is an egg yolk precursor protein. In other words, it's the egg yolk. Female fish produce it as a nutrient source for the developing embryo. Male fish have no use for it. They also have no ways of getting rid of it because they usually don't produce eggs. So it has been used pretty widely in the scientific community to determine whether or not some of these emerging contaminants are present. How is vitellogenin produced? When estrogens interact with estrogen receptors in the liver will produce this protein and pass it on to the ovary. Male fish don't produce enough estrogen to cause the induction of vitellogenin, even though they have the gene present. But if you have these emerging contaminants surrounding the fish in the water, they act just like the estrogen in the female, and as a result, the liver of the male fish will produce vitellogenin, and we can measure that very readily, and it tells us that these emerging contaminants are around. So at these sites, and there's a couple of hot spots up at Bemidji, Grand Rapids, St. Cloud, and then pretty much we're going downhill from the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities on, we have vitellogenin measured in male fish. It's the first sign of the effects of emerging contaminants on these fish. I will later on talk a little bit about why it's so difficult to reproduce many of these results in the laboratory. Vitellogenin, this egg yolk protein, is one case but we are actually able to cause the same effect in the laboratory using the same compounds. This graph here shows nothing else than the production of white halogenin by male fish exposed to nonylphenol for 21 days. Nonylphenol, to remind you, is one of those detergents that we discharge with our treated wastewater. And at concentrations that are certainly reasonable, especially if we take the mixture of these compounds together, we can induce the same egg yolk protein in male fishes in the lab. So it shows us that what we measure in the field in the Mississippi River, we can link back to emerging contaminants in the laboratory. Some of the reports, especially out of the Potomac River in Washington, D.C., are somewhat disturbing in that they show intersects in male or in fishes. At that point, you really can't call them male anymore. Intersex is a condition that has really raised some eyebrows, and we're finding it more and more. It refers to a condition in which we have fish where the reproductive organs are not just male, which is what you're seeing on the right, a male testes, and it's basically a mature testes with a lot of spermatozoa in it, or a reproductive organ that is all female, like the ovary on the left, with maturing eggs. What you see is truly an intersex structure, where you have both male sperm and female eggs in the same structure. Obviously, that's something we don't necessarily consider advantageous, although we don't yet know what the population level effects are. We're somewhat fortunate in the state of Minnesota that we have not found that condition as a widespread problem, as it has been the case in the Potomac River, in the Boulder Creek, in Boulder, or actually off the coast of California, where it actually has occurred even in the ocean. So these very small concentrations can have effects that are rather disturbing. We have not found a lot of that here in Minnesota, but we have the emerging contaminants that we know can cause intersex. Some of the current research questions that we are asking ourselves in the scientific community dealing with these compounds. A very important one is, where are these compounds coming from that we measure in the aquatic environment? Are they point source discharges, or are they non-point pollution? It's important for us to know whether these concentrations vary over time or if they're relatively stable. Can we deal just with one set of concentrations when we try to understand what happens, or do we have to deal with different concentrations? The behavior of many of these emerging contaminants, and just from these chemical formulas you saw earlier, they are a very diverse range of chemicals. They probably behave in all kinds of ways. We don't know if they break down in the water column, if they bind to the sediment, if they become more potent as they travel down the river. Are they bioconcentrating in the animal itself? And we really know very, very little about their effects once we put them in mixtures. And let's all remember, in a river system, they're not just exposed to one of those compounds, they're exposed to many of them. As far as the first question is concerned, point source versus non-point pollution, it appears clear that different compounds enter the aquatic environment through different means. We know treated wastewater discharge is a major pathway, and I want to emphasize it's a pathway. Treatment plants don't produce these things. You and I use them and discharge of them, and treatment plants deal with them. But we know treated wastewater effluent is a primary source of many of these emerging contaminants that we found in waste in the aquatic environment. We also know that some of the compounds applied to fields and used in agriculture may contribute as non-point sources of emerging contaminants. An area that has received a bit of attention, and probably will receive a lot more in the next few years, are large feedlot operations. When you have a dairy operation with many cows, these produce very high levels of estrogens. It's a natural process in a lactating mammal, and most of those will be discharged in one form or another. Do concentrations vary over time? I couldn't help myself but to include this graph on the left, and I don't want to go into much detail, but what you're seeing here in this diagram are three measurements of these mood-altering drugs as they were measured in a treated wastewater effluent. Taken at 7:30 in the morning, 2:30 in the afternoon, and after I left the opera in St. Paul at 11:30 at night. And if you look at those concentrations, without going into much detail, you can see that between 7:30 in the morning and 11:30 at night, the total concentrations have almost doubled. So we clearly have time course changes of these chemicals. Concentrations are not static. We know that in many places, mood-altering drugs are taken much higher quantities and prescribed at higher frequencies in the winter than in the summer, especially if you live up here. We know that some of these compounds are more common during the school year than during semester breaks. What makes matters even worse is that when we talk about nonylphenol, this detergent, or many of the other compounds, they're actually not one compound. Different companies produce the same compound under the same name, but when you look at a mass spec profile, which is what is in this diagram here, on this left side you list the names of six companies that all produce nonylphenol. But if you actually measure the compound and you characterize it chemically, they look very different. I don't want to go into details, but just by those columns you can see there's very little matching. So many times when we try to understand the effects of one of those compounds, we might deal with six different compounds, which doesn't help our cause a whole lot. What is the behavior of these compounds in the environment? We know of many processes that can affect the concentrations and the bioavailability of those compounds once they enter the aquatic environment. Everything from volatilization disappearing into the atmosphere to concentration in the sediments, there's many different processes that have been documented, and it depends a lot on the chemical formula and chemical behavior of every single one of these emerging contaminants. How about mixture effects? And this is probably the biggest issue we are facing in the next 10 years. I showed you the graph on the right side of the screen already before. These were the effects of a mixture of alkylphenols, these detergents, on larvae. They all died. On the left side, I take the most potent of these compounds and expose larvae to just that one compound, and we don't see any effect on survival. In other words, if we would have taken the old-fashioned approach of studying one compound at a time, we would not have found any effects in survival whatsoever. But when we put them together in the concentrations at which they are found in the environment, suddenly we see mortality. So a couple of educated guesses to conclude these current research questions. Probably both point and non-point pollution are factors in introducing these compounds into the aquatic environment. Concentrations definitely vary over time. We don't know yet by how much what the seasonal or annual variation is, but we know they vary dramatically. We know little about the fate of these compounds once they enter the aquatic environment, and probably all of the above is correct for the question of what happens to these compounds once they enter the aquatic environment. Mixture effects, we know very little. Moving on to some other question here, what about fish populations? Oops. We have done some studies looking at the food web because fish are not the only organisms that are exposed to these emerging contaminants. And we know from the old studies of DDT that sometimes the effects don't occur when you expose the organism itself, but when you expose the aquatic food chain. We have some early indications from the primary producers, those are the algae, on which most animals rely as the aquatic animals as their primary food source. When we expose these algae to nonylphenol and mixtures of alkylphenols, we actually see that their nutritional value declines dramatically. In other words, a larval fish that feeds on these compounds has to ingest two or three times as many of those compounds in order to get the same nutritional value. Unfortunately, that's not really possible because these algae come in very discrete packages and you can only fit so many into the gut of a larval fish. So, summarizing some of the questions we have regarding the fish populations. We are pretty certain that the entire aquatic food chain needs study and may be at risk from these emerging contaminants. We don't think that vitellogenin, this egg yolk protein that we measure a lot, is a very good indicator of whether or not there are problems. We can measure it and it tells us whether or not these compounds are out there, but it doesn't tell us a lot about the effects on fish. Intersex, on the other hand, probably indicates that there are some severe problems. We also have to look at different species of fish. Not all fish are alike. And we know now from our studies last summer that different species of fish, even here in Minnesota, will react very differently to the same chemical. Probably the silver lining for the state of Minnesota, although we measure emerging contaminants in several places in our study, it appears that this is still a local and not a regional or statewide problem. That's not the case for some other states, but for right now, I think we have a real opportunity to address the issue. Why do we know so little? Why can't I give you any more information? Parts per trillion are very hard to measure, especially if you're dealing with a very complex solution of many, many different chemicals. It is very difficult, and many of these analytical methods are still being developed. There's some compounds that we use at concentrations at which we expose fish that we actually can't measure yet. We know that these compounds vary over time and over distance, which makes our experiments so much harder to standardize. Also, when we go back to the available literature, the EPA approach has always been one chemical at a time. But we know that mixtures have effects that exceed well beyond what one chemical at a time will tell us. If you go to your physician and you get a prescription, the first question is, what other pharmaceuticals are you taking? We know that mixture effects can be severe, yet we have never studied them in the past in any systemic fashion. We also know the endocrine system changes. There are dramatic differences in everyone's endocrine system depending on the time of the year and in fishes depending on their reproductive status. So what is really needed is a research effort that creates a web of different studies that are all linked together. And I think this is one of the main messages that I would like to send. We have to go out, we have to measure where are these compounds coming from. We have to go into the lab and analyze them to understand what are their concentrations and what is their fate. We have to expose fish in the laboratory, link that to fish that we catch in the field to ultimately understand what the effects are on the biological organisms. Some of those efforts are already underway. And in our lab, the Aquatic Toxicology Laboratory at St. Cloud State, we are studying multi-generational effects. We're looking not just at the fish that is being exposed, but also its offspring and even second-generation effects. We're also looking at the food chain, and most importantly, we're looking at mixture effects. What you're seeing here is a diagram that we prepared for a study that the US EPA funded in our laboratory to look at mixtures of these natural estrogens, synthetic estrogens, alkylphenols, pharmaceuticals, and address their combined effect. And I think this is a very important step forward. But the probably best approach that we can use in order to understand what these emerging contaminants mean to the state of Minnesota is the kind of collaboration that I think our state can serve as a model for. Currently, we have an interagency collaboration that is second to none in this country. I have a lot of collaborators in other states that are rather jealous of the close interaction that we have between our aquatic toxicology lab, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the U.S. Geological Survey. We get phenomenal logistical support from the Met Council, especially the Metro Sewage Treatment Plant. They could close their doors and ignore this issue. Instead, they have allowed us in and dealt with all the kind of ideas that we have, sometimes rather creative ideas. And they have always been there for us. We have worked in other states where we have never gotten past the front gate. The Department of Natural Resources has provided us with a lot of logistical support as well and has been very open to studying these issues. So the interagency collaboration is really phenomenal in this state, and I feel very fortunate that I can work in this state on these issues. Just a few words in closing on human health risks. This is, of course, the issue that we all ultimately care about. It's a very tricky issue. For one thing, as I've tried to point out already, these are subtle shifts. We're dealing with almost non-traceable effects. We're dealing with natural biological pathways. We're all taking pharmaceuticals, so how can we tell whether exposure comes from something we ingest or something else that may come from the environment? We also have been exposed to so many more compounds in the last 100 years or so, ever since the chemical revolution, and this plethora of different compounds, of course, all interact with our body. I'm going to give you a couple of correlative examples and one very solid case. The solid case is diethylstilbestrol. DES is a little easier to pronounce. It was a pharmaceutical that was given to pregnant women starting in the 1940s all the way to about 1971. It was primarily used to prevent early births and also to alleviate morning sickness during pregnancy. It was really hailed as a miracle drug, and you see it has some similarity to estradiol, and it was designed to deal with the estrogen receptor. Mothers and the daughters they gave birth to did perfectly fine. They did very well. They grew up. They started their own families. And suddenly we started to see problems 20, 30 years later. The first problems that occurred were a sudden jump in clear cell carcinoma, a very unusual, very rare cancer that befalls the female reproductive system. Very, very few cases were ever seen by physicians, and suddenly they started popping up more frequently. Subsequent studies showed that daughters of women that took DES during pregnancy experienced much lower levels of full-term pregnancies and much higher levels of miscarriages than daughters that were born to women that never took that pharmaceutical. It took 20 to 30 years for those effects to manifest themselves. There are currently second-generation studies underway. They haven't found anything, thankfully, at that level. That's one case where there's a very strong correlation. A slightly weaker correlation comes from a study done on women, wives of Lake Michigan fishermen. Naturally, they have a relatively high diet of fishes, and fish in Lake Michigan tend to have fairly high PCB levels, another emerging contaminant and endocrine disruptor. And 11 years after children were born to these women, these wives of Lake Michigan fishermen, a much higher incident rate of mental retardation and developmental retardation was found in the offspring. There are questions about those studies, and I don't want to hide those, but again, a correlation here between emerging contaminants and some of these effects. Human epidemiology gives us some other examples, and they also illustrate some of the problems and some of the difficulties in linking emerging contaminants to health effects. Breast cancer rates have been on the rise, and I believe this year for the first time they have started to fall, by about 30% in the last 25 years. There's a lot of reasons for that. We can think of a greater effort for early detection. If we detect breast cancer before it spreads, we diagnose it as breast cancer, not as some other form of cancer. Changes in our lifestyles. We smoke less, therefore other cancers become more prevalent. Greater life expectancy. We live longer, cancers are more likely to pop up. But we also have that increasing exposure to emerging contaminants, and we know the estrogen receptors are very much involved in breast cancer and breast cancer treatment. Similarly, in males, testicular cancer rates have been on the rise as well, and many of the same questions and correlations apply as well. Probably the strongest case for the effects of emerging contaminants on the human population come from long-term studies of sperm density in men. These studies started in the U.S. in the 1940s. They were actually draftees where sperm density was measured. They have continued on and started in Europe in the 60s, and they found roughly a 50% decline in sperm densities in male in the Western Hemisphere. We know that many of these emerging contaminants can have effects on sperm production. We also know that in those parts of the world that have not seen the same level of industrialization and chemical exposure, we do not see that decrease in sperm density. The data you see here look very clean. There are meta studies where many studies have been combined that explains why you have very clean graphs. One last point here. We know from several studies on rats that mammals are affected by these compounds even during early embryonic and fetal development. The study here, and this is a very abbreviated version of it, was conducted by several professors who marked the position of embryos in a rat during pregnancy. They literally went in, marked each individually, reported whether it was male or female, and that's what you're seeing on the left, and then allowed the rat to give birth and followed those rats, the male rats, to adulthood. And what you see on the right is essentially what they found. A male embryo that was positioned in the uterus between two males grew up to be very aggressive. A male embryo that was positioned between two females during pregnancy grew up to be overly submissive. And only the rats, the male rats, in uterus that were positioned between another male and another female embryo grew up to behave what we would consider the normal behavior of a rat, whatever that is. What that indicates is that and what I need to point out here, of course, is that female rat embryos actually release estrogens already during the development. And the hypothesis here is that those very minute amounts of estrogen affect the behavior of the male fetuses as well. It's an indication that very, very small concentration of these compounds can have effects all the way into adulthood. I wish we knew more about those compounds. I wish we knew more about the health risks on the human population, but right now it's really more an issue of having a precautionary public health approach until those studies are carried further. I want to conclude with just a few suggestions from my experience working in this field for about 10 years, which is about as long as we know about these emerging contaminants. The model we have working right now in Minnesota, I think, is a very good model and one that should be sustained, and that is to promote communication between agencies, between academia and the state and federal agencies. There's a lot of data sets out there, and the more we talk, the more data sets we find, but those need to be integrated. Right now, there are many efforts out there by many agencies on the state and federal level, by universities, to study some of those things, to go out to measure them in the wild. And many times we do the same thing in close proximity without knowing of each other. It requires state oversight in order to change that. I would love to switch my study site if I knew somebody else was studying pesticides and mercury in the same system. My data would have much more interpretive power. We need to focus on education. Everybody grew up knowing that expired pharmaceuticals should be flushed down the toilet. It's just about the worst thing we can do. That's how many of these compounds end up in the environment. There are means, very simple means, to get rid of many of those problems. Very cheap means, just general education. Antimicrobial hand soaps have absolutely no place in most households. We don't need them. A little dirt doesn't hurt. These are also not compounds that we can regulate at the discharge site. It's not up to the treatment plants to take care of those of these compounds. Their quantities are so minute, wastewater treatment plants were not designed to deal with them. And there's so many different ones that it would be cost prohibitive to deal with all of them. Many of those compounds are produced and used by a few heavy users. If we regulate those, we can avoid a lot of the problems down the road and down the waterways. We do have to become more creative. The old-time toxicology just doesn't work very well. And we have to focus on long-term goals because these are not issues that will go away. We're not going to ban pharmaceuticals, obviously. We need them. But we have to study these things in the long range, and we have to find ways to maybe make them a little less problematic for the environment. There are chemical means to do so. But that requires an approach that focuses on basic research. Basic research often seems very esoteric. We do these kind of silly little things out there in our laboratories and our ivory towers. Even in St. Cloud, we have an ivory tower. But actually, basic research ultimately started our understanding down this pathway, and I think ultimately the solutions will rest with basic research. I conclude with that and entertain any questions you may have. Thank you.
Members, this is very sobering. I suspect no questions. Representative Hockey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Got to find my question. Two questions. Dr. Schoenfuss, going back to one of the early slides, perfluorochemicals,
yes,
the Teflon pans and things, how do those get into the water?
These compounds are usually placed on top of some sort of another carrier, maybe the food packaging, a Teflon pan, or whatever it may be. And they wash off over time. They literally leach out, just like the bisphenol A will leach out of a plastic bottle. So it's a very slow process, but it's such a quantity of these compounds that we're using, and particularly with the perfluorochemicals, the reason we start measuring them in relatively high concentrations has to do with their behavior in the environment. So although they leach out at very slow, at very low concentrations, they don't seem to degrade a whole lot, though, so they're starting to build up over time. So it's probably not a problem that even if we were stopped to use these compounds right away, that would go away very quickly. It's a little bit like DDT in that respect.
Thank you. I have one other question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Schoenfuss, when you were doing the different spots in the river where you were checking the fish, were there some sites that you measured where you found no vitellogenin?
Yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yes, we did find, we actually, and I was very encouraged by that, a lot of the upstream sites, upstream of the Twin Cities, were free of vitellogenin-induced male fishes. There were a couple of hot spots, usually close to major urban centers, or minor urban centers. But generally, there were a lot of sites that were still clean, which is why I tend to believe that this is still a localized problem in our state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on Representative Hoppe's question, one of those two of those hot spots you said were Bemidji and Grand Rapids, a parochial concern to me. Could you maybe hypothesize as to the source of that up there, or any other insights you could give us?
Sure. Bemidji, most likely the wastewater treatment plant was upstream of our sample site. And again, wastewater treatment plants are a major pathway for those compounds to enter the aquatic environment. I want to emphasize, they don't produce them, we produce them, but they are usually channeled into the aquatic environment through treated wastewater effluent. Similarly, in Grand Rapids, we also have a wastewater treatment plant. We also have a pulp and paper mill up there. And we know that those effluents can be containing a lot of emerging contaminants, and actually they have been studied rather extensively.
You also talked early in your presentation about some wastewater treatment plants are effective at removing pharmaceuticals, unused pharmaceuticals, and others aren't. Could you maybe... and I know that the Bemidji wastewater treatment plant doesn't have specific means to remove them. Maybe you could comment on that a little bit and how expensive that might be.
Yes, there are different treatment protocols, and many of those are being tested right now on a nationwide scale. There are certain technologies like ozonation of effluents, UV radiation, that probably will get rid of many of these compounds. The problem is the scaling up to the size of a major sewage treatment plant. So there are mechanisms out there, and their effectiveness, I think, still needs to be tested, but at least on a small scale, we know they're removable. It's just an issue of how much it costs and whether that's the most cost-effective way of dealing with them.
Representative Clark is next. We have a number of questions. We'll get them all. Representative Clark.
I want to thank you for your presentation. It was very thorough, and I'm sorry I had to step out a couple times. I missed some of it, but I wondered, I was here when you were talking about the interagency collaboration. So I have one question about that, and then I have another question about the PFCs. But in terms of interagency collaboration, I noticed that the Department of Agriculture is not one of the departments that's listed as cooperating in this effort, and I'm glad to see that the Metro Council, the Pollution Control Agency, but both the Department of Agriculture, and I don't see the Department of Health either, as being part of the current interagency collaboration. Could you tell me if what's going on there?
Sure, and this is really not their fault. It's just an issue that this collaboration is starting to grow, and I hope that more and more of those agencies will join in. So it's merely a matter that we have interacted more and more closely over the last 3 or 4 years, and as we have built this collaboration, those agencies just have not yet been part of that, and I'm sure we will approach them as well, and I do hope that they will collaborate just as well as the other agencies have done.
Thank you. Has the Department of Health been invited to this point yet?
I can't answer that question because I have not been the one that established the collaboration.
That's okay. That's the next committee, and I'll ask that question. On the issue of the fluoro chemicals, you probably heard the information that kind of broke over the week, I guess last Friday afternoon over the weekend, about the fluoro chemical contamination in Cottage Grove and downstream from the 3M plants. And I'm just wondering if you, the question was asked as the source of those that contamination. I'm just wondering if you have anything more to say about that, and if you're involved in any of that research and with the people who've been working on it or not yet.
No, we have not been involved in that research to date. We have sent out some samples to measure within our fish to understand better where the effects that we are observing might come from, what compounds. One of the big problems with perfluoro chemicals is that we understand very little about its effects on the endocrine system. We know it potentially can have similar effects to some of the ones I described for alpha phenols, but the studies are pretty much in infancy, and one of the problems is that literally analytical methods are being developed right now to accurately identify those compounds in a very complex aquatic environment. So we're still waiting for the tools to really assess those kind of compounds in the laboratory.
Madam Chair? Last follow-up on this. I understand, though, that 3M itself and then a Canadian laboratory that's been involved in this do have those analytical tools, and maybe I'll just refer you to them, and we can talk more about it later.
Thanks.
Representative Peterson is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if you have found different concentrations in rivers versus lakes, and I couldn't tell from your map. And specifically, you know, the Mississippi River flows through Lake Bemidji, Cass Lake, and Winnebagoshish. Have you sampled those types of lakes that have rivers running through them?
No, we have not measured lakes, and I think lakes is lakes have been a little bit neglected in that effect. We have all the samples were taken directly out of the rivers, and in Bemidji we actually sampled between the two lakes right in Bemidji. So, no, we have not done any extensive lake studies.
Okay, one follow-up, if I may. Yeah, thank you. So, have you found that, if it's the regression analysis or not, I'm not exactly what applies to it, is the endocrine disruptor uptake in fish higher in lower water years, or have you determined an average water year amount in the river that when you're sampling over space and time, mm-hmm. as have you found higher percentages of disruptors in low water years?
We know that dilution is a major factor. We know that for a fact. I wish I had the answer for the uptake. Actually, that is one of the, it's an excellent question. It's one of the main research questions that needs to be answered. There's a difference between what we can measure in the environment and what a fish actually takes up. It's usually considered or referred to as bioavailability. So just because it's in the water doesn't necessarily mean the fish can take it up. One of the things we have found, especially with mixtures, is that some of these detergents, these alpha phenols, will actually facilitate the uptake of other compounds because they're designed to break that membrane, that lipid membrane that protects the body, and they're designed to breach that membrane and therefore allow other chemicals to enter the fish much more readily. So uptake is a huge issue, and it's not a big one that needs to be studied extensively. And I don't think there's anybody out there doing it right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Galati has the next question.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Dr. Schoenfuss, can you tell us then the best low-cost way to dispose of pharmaceuticals, or maybe the next best low-cost way? Maybe there's different ways to do it, and also the strategy for educating the public in this regard.
Yes. I think the best solution with pharmaceuticals is to bring them back to the pharmacy. pharmacies, I believe, are required to take back pharmaceuticals, and they have the proper channels of disposing of them. Usually incineration will alleviate those problems. In terms of the education of the general public, certainly starting with pharmaceuticals and their disposal is a very good way to start. I think what we saw, the educational campaign that surrounded fertilizers and banning some of the fertilizers in the Twin Cities, was probably a very good approach that may work for some of these compounds as well, more on a voluntary basis. So, for example, antimicrobial soaps. For most of us, unless there's somebody in the family that has a severe illness, we don't need antimicrobial soaps. We should just go with the old-fashioned soaps. They do just as fine. There are several of those educational components that could be included in a very basic educational campaign that probably would, especially in this state, and this is the other great thing about working in Minnesota, people really care about their water. And I think it would be relatively easy to make that linkage between what's in the water and what we use in the household and therefore send that way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I have a great deal of trouble wrapping my brain around parts per trillion. I assume that that means there are some huge number, though, of these molecules that, you know, it's not just like a few molecules, it's a great many. Is the chemistry of this such that one molecule is enough for each receptor? Is that the deal? So that the size of the organism then is important in the concentration. Does this then work? Is that permanent once it's bound? Is the first part of the question, or don't we know?
No, it's not permanent, and that makes it hard for us to study because these receptor sites constantly bind to a molecule and then release the molecule again. If it would be a permanent binding, we could very easily measure that, and we would have that fingerprint, that trace of the effect of the emerging contaminant. This way, we don't know if an effect is due to a surge of hormones produced by the animal or hormones affecting the animal on the from the outside. So it is a reversible process.
And so this would not be necessarily a cumulative effect like heavy metals, where your study fatheads got eaten by the perch that the walleye that I caught ate, and so I'm going to start producing eggs here or anything like that.
You're correct. It's probably not an issue of bioaccumulation for most of these compounds. It is a cumulative effect in the same sense as hearing loss is a cumulative effect. Every time you're exposed to a noise, it degrades your hearing ability, and after many years, that can have severe effects on your hearing. Every time these compounds bind to the receptors, when they're not supposed to, as an exogenous hormone or molecule, binding to the receptor, it will cause a developmental effect that will build up over time. And one of the issues, and it relates to the concentrations, and they're varying over time. One of the things we don't understand well yet is whether it's those peak concentrations that we worry about, the average concentration, or the total load that an animal will experience of emerging contaminants over a long period of time. But they do build up in the sense of that the organism is being affected adversely every time they're exposed to one of those compounds, and every time it will push them a little bit off their normal path of development and reproduction till the effects might be severe enough that we can actually measure them.
Thank you.
I do see one more question, and then I'll ask the last question when we need some other folks come.
Representative, Doctor, you may have mentioned, you said these are fairly long lasting chemicals, and I'm just wondering if you can give us a sense of weeks, months, years. So if we do start decreasing the load we put into our waters, how long it would take for our actual concentrations of these to decrease?
That's a very good question that we worry about as well. It depends a lot on the class of compounds. We know that actually estradiol, the natural hormone, is relatively stable in the aquatic environment. The alkylphenols, these detergents, generally break down to nonylphenol, and then there's a huge scientific debate on whether or not that nonylphenol goes away, breaks down, or actually binds to the sediments, and there seems to be a agreement building that it probably binds to the sediment and is around for a long time, order of months to years. Probably with the perfluorochemicals, years, many years. Pharmaceuticals, some of them will break down relatively quickly, other ones will be around for a while, but I think that's an area where probably cessation of dumping them into the wastewater stream will have a fairly significant effect very quickly. And probably similarly with the detergents, we can probably, because they're produced at such high quantities, we may be able to have a fairly quick effect just by reducing the usage of those compounds. So most of these compounds, order of months to years, some of them longer, a few of them probably much shorter half-life. The problem is, of course, we're continuously producing more and more of them, so if we can stop the usage, we probably see effects relatively readily.
I'll take the last question then. Other than the Mississippi River, where have tests been done in Minnesota?
This goes back to integrating data sets. Different agencies have studied the Minnesota River, some of the smaller streams in the state, and it's very hard to get a handle of all of those data. And one of the efforts we're having going on that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is really leading is trying to pull a lot of that information together. We are planning this year to go in several streams to understand a little more about the concentrations, the changes over time, and the fate of those compounds in streams. Minnesota River, for sure, the St. Croix has seen some work, and then a lot of small studies, a site here, site there. Probably if you could all map them out, if you get all the information, it's probably a fairly substantial effort, but that information is so spread out, and it takes somebody to integrate all those data sets.
So we really don't have the results yet of anything except the work you have done and presented to us. Is that what I'm understanding? The results that are public and that we can talk about here.
In terms of things that have gone through peer review, there's relatively little out there. There should be more, and there needs to be more put out.
We really appreciate your coming and helping us understand this. It's sobering. But it's better to understand and move forward than not. Thank you for taking the time and driving down through St. Paul this morning. Thank you very much. We'll next have folks from LCCMR come up, and we will, it's abbreviated, they are going to be back on Thursday. We will have them come back. You'll end on time today, and at 9:30, and then we'll have LCCMR back with us on Thursday. Also going to have a presentation on the statewide conservation preservation plan, which is brand new and I think exciting and something we all need to understand so we can have some input into it. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Valine. I'm the Director for the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources, LCCMR, a new entity created in 2006. To my right is Assistant Director Susan Thornton. I'd like to briefly also introduce Michael McDonough, who's our Manager of Research and Planning, and Diana Griffith, who's our Commission Assistant. The staff of four is a small but very hardworking and very loyal group. We are decidedly nonpartisan, and we keep it that way so that we can serve the full legislature through the full commission. In your packets, you have a blue book that's our biennial report, and inside of that there should be a slightly different colored blue sheet and then a set of color prints from the Minnesota Lottery. Madam Chair, as I understand, the plan is to give a basic overview of the LCCMR, what it is, what it does, how it got here, and so forth today, and then we'll go through the recommendations on Thursday after the statewide plan.
Sounds good.
So we will go fairly quickly. You can read this blue sheet. It's a nice little outline, I think, that mainly Susan has prepared, and it does very nicely. I'd like to highlight a couple of points. Susan will also highlight a couple of points. The trust fund was started in 1988, and over time, after a few different changes, it was set out to receive 40% of the net proceeds. That's of the profits, not of the ticket dollars, but of the profits. And notice that the next bullet down talks about the fiscal 06 net proceeds. That's the amount into the lottery, or excuse me, from the lottery into the trust fund, and that was $32 million. The 40% of net proceeds gets to around 6.5-7 some years more cents per dollar. So if you buy a ticket, you can figure you're giving somewhere between a nickel and 10 cents into the trust fund. And then the next line is that the average net proceeds, and that's an annual figure, is about $23.4 million. So clearly, fiscal 06 was a banner year. The body of the trust fund is an endowment. It's a state-owned endowment, a permanent endowment. On the back of this blue sheet, you see the language of the Constitution, including all of the language and the dates of amendment. That's what the trust fund is supposed to do. You notice it's a permanent fund. The corpus, or the body, of that fund remains inviolate. You cannot spend the corpus. The people have said, this is what we want. And so the legislature can spend up to 5.5% of the corpus. Now, because the endowment is managed by the State Board of Investment in very long-term growth, with a very long-term growth strategy, when you spend 5.5%, that automatically means in almost every year that you are leaving behind a fair amount of growth, so that the trust fund will continue to grow out into the future, and that the annual or biennial allocations won't bother the corpus at all. A few lines down, you see the corpus value as of June 30 was $415 million. There was a time in the recent years when the corpus did pretty well, and a time in recent years when the corpus didn't do so well, because the stock market mainly, it's a 70% stock, 30% bond mixture, and so there'll be some fluctuations. But it's on the rise, and as it gets bigger, you'll see the corpus grow even more. And so that yields about $22,866,000 that can be spent for each of the two next fiscal years. We're going to talk on Thursday about the Commission's recommendation for just 2007. Then the Commission will go through a process of recommending again for 2008, during the 2008 session, for fiscal 8 and fiscal 9. And the expenditures, again, are governed by the Constitution that's shown on the backside. And it's very important to note that the statute that's shown below, MS-116.08, is the same statute that was in place when the citizens adopted the trust fund constitutional language. So the combination of the statutory language, the constitutional language, and the statutory language has been the driver for all these years. The other handout is from the lottery website. It's all their information, but I wanted to show you that the lottery is not a simple operation by any means. And you'll see that one of the wedges in there that happens to be colored green, I thought that was clever of them, goes to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and that shows that $32 million number for fiscal year 2006. Again, it was a little higher than it had been in previous years. And then all of the other allocations, including the general fund. Obviously, the big thing is the prizes paid to players. I don't think a lot of people realize that the players get back quite a bit, along with retailers and others. And then there are many other sources of that lottery money: the Natural Resources Fund, the Game and Fish Fund, and so forth, receive Game and Fish Fund, and so forth, receive fair amounts of money, too.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Susan Thornton with the LCCMR staff. And I was going to briefly just touch base on LCCMR refresher for returning members and for new members go through the makeup of the LCCMR and how it came to be. The LCCMR, Legislative Citizen Commission, Minnesota Resources, is the successor to the former Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources. The LCCMR was established in last year in legislation, Chapter 243, and that was the result of a task force that was set up and actually presented a report to the legislature just about a year ago recommending the governing structure for trust fund expenditure recommendations. And that task force was co-chaired by Representative Solberg and Dave Zentner and was made up of legislative appointments and governor's appointments. The 17 members of the commission are advisory to you, the legislature, and the membership are five from the House, five from the Senate, and at least two minority members of those five, and then seven non-legislative appointed citizen members. And those members are five are appointed by the governor, one by the House, and one by the Senate. And they're appointed for staggered terms. It's been a long fall. They may be staggering right now. Sorry. The appointments were just finally completed in August, the end of August of 2006. And as John said, we are now going from biennial recommendations to annual recommendations to the legislature for trust fund expenditures. That was one of the recommendations of the task force that was put into law that we do annual cycles. A couple of other recommendations besides the governing structure were the establishment of an emerging issues account and also regional block grants. And the appropriations recommended need to adhere to the trust fund constitution, 116P.08, which we pointed out to you on the back of the blue sheet here, and an adopted strategic plan. And John will then continue on what those fall 2006 activities that we've been doing that are also included in your biennial report, which have culminated in the recommendations to you for this legislative session.
Okay. John, Mr. Levine, before you start, Representative Hansen has a question. Representative Solberg has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Valina, I wanted to go back to the lottery just for a moment before we got into the LCCMR. You mentioned that at the end of the sheet with the pie chart, it has 4.96% go into the lottery in lieu of goes into the environment. Is it correct that still about 22% of the lottery in lieu of go into the general fund?
Madam Chair, we don't have that particular breakdown with us just now. Unless Jim, might you know what goes into the lottery in lieu? I think the question is, how is the lottery in lieu of sales tax money? How is it divided? Where is it deposited?
I think about 22% of it goes into the general fund. But I can get that information later. The second question was on unclaimed prize money. How much of that is collected per year, and where does that go?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I just spoke to the lottery about that not too long ago. And up through 2003, the unclaimed prize money went to the trust fund, as along with the net proceeds. It was determined to be part of the net proceeds. And at that time, it was about in the range of $2 million a year. In speaking to staff at the lottery about a month or so ago, it's my understanding they're projecting that unclaimed prize money to be about $8.4 million next fiscal year. It's about about $7 million this fiscal year. It's an approximation. And that currently goes to the general fund, as I understand.
Representative Solberg,
just a point of clarification, Madam Chair. On your blue sheet, very bottom bullet, that for fiscal year 08, the commission is recommending. Is that 07 instead of 08? Are you doing it on a yearly basis?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, as long as I've been around here, I always get this mixed up. That is fiscal 08, which is the fiscal year beginning July 1st, 2007. So we're recommending to the 2000 session of the legislature and again to the 2008 session of the legislature, and those fiscal years will be 08 and 09.
Yeah.
To be divided the way the fiscal year goes. And that's an opportunity. I'm sorry.
You're correct.
And I also have to think that out, too. that's an opportunity to emphasize that the legislature required annual cycles for the commission, and that this is, this money, we'll see you again in a year from now with a whole new set of additional recommendations.
We're looking forward to that, but in the meantime, Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Valen or Ms. Thornton, either one of you can answer this. In the statutes on the back sheet side of our blue sheet here, it has exception subdivision 2, things that the trust fund cannot be used for, and it seems as though in our current clean water legacy environment here that perhaps we should maybe revisit that. Is there any, could you give us any insight onto why those exceptions were originally put there in the statute?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, yes. The if you look at those items, number one is the Superfund sites. Potentially enormous amounts of money. In 1988, people were recognizing that there were potentially enormous amounts of money, which if we started spending on the Superfund, the spending would only go to the Superfund. Moving down to municipal sewage number two, the same thing. I've forgotten what the dollar amounts are, but they're numbers that are staggering when you think about the total need and how many communities around the state have been on the list, and we still can't get to them. $40 million of dollars per year and so forth. Again, the same concern. Nuclear power plants, the same kind of enormous issue that would dwarf the trust fund in no time at all. And hazardous waste and solid waste, similarly, were issues that were deemed to be of such individual importance all by themselves that they would simply dwarf the effort, because the funding amount that coming from the lottery would never be enough to even approach reasonable solutions. Now, recognize that, especially in number two, for example, that's building and operating municipal sewage plants. We have actually done, and you heard from Dr. Schoenfuss a little while ago, we've done some research around municipal water pollution control in order to help the effort, either determine if they're doing things right. We had a project last year, 2003, that actually went through and determined what mechanisms were available, necessary, and would be cost-effective to remove even more phosphorus from municipal treatment than had already occurred. And that report actually was helpful to a number of the, I think there were 17 facilities around the state. So while it doesn't fund the building and operation of them, we have done a few things around the edge to help the effort along a little bit without getting into the mainstream.
Representative, Madam Chair, thank you for your clarification. I appreciate that. My next question is on the where the money goes. Minnesota State Lottery handout that we have a pie chart in front of us here. It says not less than in the Constitution, not less than 40% can go to the fund, the general fund. But the proceeds are divided up in certain percentages here, and I wondered if you could, with 15% of that, of the total dollars going to the general fund, I think that would probably be 7% approximately of the part that goes to the state government. Maybe you could explain to us where these percentages come from. Is that in statute, or is there some arbitrary nature to that? You follow my question?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, for the most part, those are in statute. For example, looking down in the lower right-hand corner, there's a certain amount maximum that goes to retailers and a certain amount divided, set aside maximum for administration. The trust fund has a 40% of the actual proceeds, so that's calculated as the proceeds are determined, net proceeds are determined. And both the Game and Fish and Natural Resources Fund, that's an even split done by statute as well. And then the general fund, I think the general fund just gets the rest. I don't think it's actually statutory. It's whatever's left after those the statutory amounts come up.
If we could ask, what I think we'll do right now, ask Mr. Reinholtz if he'll ask this question, and we're going to have to I think, end for the day. We're going to take our minutes. And but let's start with Mr. Reinholzer.
Madam Chair, members, the question was asked by Representative Hansen on the percentage of the lottery and lieu dollars, where those go. I had to look that up. That's changed several times over recent years, so I wanted to look it up before I answered. Currently, 72.43% of the revenues are deposited to be used for the Heritage Enhancement or the Natural Resources Fund. So the remainder amount is currently going to the general fund, which is 26 point some amount.
With that, I think we're going to have to end for today. Two things I'd like to do are note for the record that the House file that we'll be considering on Thursday is 293 instead of 295, and I would recognize Representative Doty.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes for January 19th to be approved.
I see no objection. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. And with that, this committee is adjourned.